a quorum present. I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 18th, 2015.
Madam Chair, I move we approve the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Representative Christensen moves approval of the minutes for March 18th. Any additional corrections or changes? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Representative Schumacher moves House File 970 to be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. We have the bill before us. Representative Schumacher, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And actually, we're going to be talking about House File 970 and 971 just kind of as a group because they're dealing with the same issues as we move forward here, but take a little bit of a different approach based on just trying to throw everything against the wall and see what sticks. The two bills we're looking at today are certainly a change in our current discussions that we typically have in the committee. Today we are discussing the transition from the twilight of life to life passing into the end of life. What we have discussed often in this committee, though, is the need to plan for the care that we want and need in the future, as well as the ideal to have choices in that planning. We have also done well in this committee to work using data to drive our decisions, and today's bill is prompted by the 2010 National Center of Health Statistics that reported that while 70% of people say they would prefer to die at home, nearly 76% die in an institution where they are likely to receive more aggressive, more invasive care than they would at home. For patients and their loved ones, no care decisions are more difficult than those made near the end of life. Effective advanced care planning, however, can make those difficult decisions easier to understand and follow. Advanced care planning is a process that can involve multiple conversations with loved ones about the goals and preferences related to the end-of-life care choices. Honoring Choices Minnesota is a resource available to communities to help facilitate those conversations. Since 2008, Honoring Choices Minnesota has been operational in the Twin Cities, and the two House files in front of us today would provide for greater statewide expansion of the program. As of 2014, 35% of Minnesota patients report completing a health care directive. The national average is only 26%. In its first 6 years in operation, Honoring Choices Minnesota is helping bring up the national average. With me today are Dr. Ken Kephart, Medical Director of Honoring Choices Minnesota, and Sue Shetley, the CEO, the CEO of Twin Cities Medical Society, to offer you further testimony and answer your questions.
Well, thank you. My name is Ken Kephart. As was mentioned, I'm a physician, family physician. Most of my work now is with the elderly. My practice is mainly in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. I can't tell you how often we have difficult discussions around end-of-life care with families and patients and how difficult it is if the family is put in the position of being asked to make decisions without having any specific discussions with their loved one about what they would want done. So I'm here to testify in favor and on behalf of the House File 971 and 970. And I'll give a story. So it seems like it would be a pretty straightforward issue to have somebody talk about what they would want done as they approach the end of life, have them pick a person to make decisions for them if they're too ill to make the decision and can't participate, and then any specific instructions they may want as they care instructions as they approach the end of life. But it actually, in reality, is more complicated and takes some skill in asking the right questions around maybe an obvious the choice is who do you want to make a decision. I had a recent conversation with a man with very end-stage heart failure, had been in the hospital a couple times, been intubated a few times, and we were trying to discuss in the time he had left how he would want to be treated if he got worse. And he was pretty clear. His wife was in the room, and he said, well, I'm okay going to the hospital. I want to get treated for anything that's reversible, but I don't want to be intubated again ever. If I can't survive without being intubated, I don't want to live. So that decision he didn't want. And as he was saying that, the wife was getting a little more agitated and turned pale. And I turned to her, and she was the one that he had selected to make his decisions, as natural. And I asked her directly if she would be able to carry out her husband's wishes, especially around intubation. She said no, never could make that decision not to intubate him if she was asked. And understood where he was coming from, but just said she couldn't do that, she couldn't make that decision. So we pulled in some of these old children, and one of them stepped up, and she said, well, I can do that. I can carry that out. I can take that burden away from my mother and make that decision. So without that kind of detailed discussion, you can't get to the to a place that allows the family to go through a really stressful situation without having severe family discord and conversations that, in the lack of any specific decisions, our current medical practice is people get all treatment unless somebody calls it off, which means that, unfortunately, a fair number of people end up dying in the ICU after months of somewhat futile therapy because nobody can make a decision. And our Honoring Choices program has been active for about 6 years. We've been really, I think, successful, especially within the healthcare systems, to start having conversations within clinics and hospitals around this, and more importantly, or as important, having these results of the discussions in a findable place so when they're needed, they can be found and used. We've also found out over the last several years that there's a fair amount of people who aren't actively engaged in clinics and hospitals, or who don't trust this type of conversation to happen inside the walls of a hospital. And so a lot of our activity now is in directly in the community to have trusted people within the community and the religious organizations, community leaders, different cultural and ethnic groups, to train people to start the discussion in a safe place where people are comfortable having those discussions, and then take that information back to their clinics or have it available when they need care. So I think I'll close with just a few more statistics. I can talk for a long time about this, but I don't want to take up your time. I'd have to answer any questions. So basically, currently, when people are in their last 6 months of life, they see 10 or more specialists. That tells you, gives you a little idea of the complexity of care at the end of life and how many people can be involved and how many times a family may be asked, well, what do you want done? From six different perspectives or 10 different perspectives. That can be very confusing, and that's why the family needs to be pretty solid in what they think their loved one would want. 7 of 10 patients say they would prefer to die at home, yet only 15% do. Nearly 70% die in a nursing home or hospital or other senior facility. So, and not as many people use hospice as could benefit by it at the end of life. So that's the current situation. I think we can do better, and we're just asking for your support to allow us to take this effort into the outstate regions and help communities establish functional programs that will help work in their communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kephart. Representative Miller, you had a question?
Yeah, quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, thanks for coming in this morning. How's this different from a living will?
Dr. Kephart.
How is this different from a living will?
Yes, thank you for that question, actually. And the living will is part of it. It's certainly an advanced care plan. What has been clear over the last several decades since living wills have been introduced in legislation to allow patients the right to choose to refuse treatment as well as accept it, we found that really hasn't changed. It's a piece of paper at a point in time that hasn't really been very helpful when people need it. It's either not found or it's out of date. But what the current data shows is that the most important thing is to have somebody to speak for you if you can't speak for yourself in a certain situation, because you're always asked at any point in time if you still want this done, even if you have a living will. And you can change your mind at any time. And people change their mind 3 or 4 times during the course of their last few years of life frequently as they experience different things and they feel differently about it. So those of us who are doing this work a lot have become much less impressed with the value of a living will and much more impressed with the value of conversations with families and then having some kind of record of who's the person that we should be talking to and what some basic values are, but not the specifics in a living will. So it's a small part of it, but probably not the most important part.
One more small question, Madam Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Doctor, I know from firsthand experience how the living will thing works, and I know that it gets even though it's a living will, legally it gets kind of messy. So can you just, it doesn't have to be a long answer, but can you explain how you navigate some of the legal issues or some of the end-of-life care that doctors are, I guess, required to do, how that plays out in these, you know, in these final decision-making times? Does that make sense? It's kind of a muddled question, but you understand what I'm asking.
Dr. Geppert.
Well, there are certainly situations that get very complex, especially if somebody has a clear legal advance directive, which a living will is one of those types of instruments, that has specific do's and don'ts. And the family member who may have been chosen as their legal healthcare agent starts making different decisions. So that's one of the common situations, unfortunately, that we come across. And that ends up to be very problematic. Usually everybody errs in the sight of not doing anything that's irreversible, so generally care is continued, full care is continued until that conflict can be resolved. And sometimes it goes to an ethics committee in the hospital. We've had people sit in the ICU for 3 weeks trying to get this type of discord sorted out.
Thank you, Dr. Geppert. Any more questions? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I'm very interested in this kind of approach, and I think this is, thank you, Representative Schumacher. I think it's really important to pay attention to this topic. I totally agree with that, and for a whole host of reasons. But my question, just looking at the bill, is about the dates that are in here. So on 2.12, applicants must submit a grant application to the commissioner by September 1st, 2015, which is a pretty short timeline. And then on 2.25, by August 1st, 2015, the commissioner shall award a grant. How does that work? Is there just a mistake or what? I mean, I'm just kind of wondering why we would have such short timelines, too, because is this one of those bills that's just written for a particular organization to be able to get a grant? And sorry, I came in a little bit late this morning. But if we're going to have a real process of people applying for a grant, usually I would think we need a bit longer timeline than this.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, and I think we phoned a friend, so if you could just identify yourself for the record.
Sure. My name is Sue Shuttle. I'm the CEO of the Twin Cities Medical Society.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So if I'm understanding your point or your question, you're wondering about Section 2.25 and also the date of when the award would be given. Is that right? So the technical assistance piece that that you refer to in section three, we are not, Honoring Choices is not written into this bill. I guess that's the first thing I will say. We are a statewide advanced care planning resource that is available. We're operational. We're here in the metro area, and we certainly would be one of the organizations that would apply for that funding or for this technical assistance if we could serve in that role. I think that the dates are a bit aggressive. However, on the other hand, if Honoring Choices were to be funded to support this work, we're already doing it. So there wouldn't be a lot of ramp up on from our perspective. So the August 1st date is something that I think is achievable. I agree that maybe the September or the quick turnaround of putting an RFP out for grantees and then getting that award is a bit aggressive. But I also know that what's going on across the state, there's a lot of interest in this issue, and I suspect that through our network and through the healthcare partners that we have across the state, that once this opportunity is presented, that people will organize rather quickly, and it should go pretty quickly from there. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Representative Liebling, a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I think, you know, that might be just fine. I guess I would just ask the author to kind of keep that in mind as the bill moves forward, whether any of that needs adjusting, because that was kind of my concern. I mean, I don't have a good sense of who's out there that might qualify to apply for these things or might want to apply, and I just don't want to have the the deadline so aggressive that they will fence out anybody who isn't already prepared and already thinking about it and de facto keep it to only certain applicants. So I just would say to Representative Schumacher to kind of keep that in the back of your mind, and this bill will have some more stops, I know. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my questions really are a follow-up to questions that were just asked. How many organizations provide this type of care, and how are you currently funded, and how are they currently funded?
We don't miss dental. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Just to clarify, we're not providing the care. We're providing the model
service,
right? There are a few organizations I could see that would be able to do this kind of thing. There are some that are doing a smaller version of what we're doing and could therefore apply for this kind of funding. Don't know if I should name them here today, but I can think of a few that would be able to apply for this and could scale up.
And
Representative Newton?
To follow on, how are they? How are you funded, and how are they funded?
Michelle. Yes. We are funded and have been funded since we started this work, primarily by the hospital systems, health insurers, and from community foundations. You should have in your materials an update for the community that's hot off the press. And if you look at the back page, it shows the listing of supporters and funders. Some of these organizations funded us when we first began, and others have funded us all along. But you can see we've got health insurance companies, primarily metro-based health systems, AARP. You could read the list just as well as I can. So it's broad-based funding.
Madam Chair.
Representative Newton.
Just follow up. And is there an indication that these organizations are no longer going to fund you? Is that why you're requesting the grant?
Ms. Shuttle? There is always that worry. What we are proposing with this grant is that the funding for the metro area Honoring Choices work is carved out, because I'm hopeful and I would like to believe, and I do believe, that there will be a level of funding to support the metro-based work. These two bills support dividing the state into three sections, with the metro area being carved out of that. So it's north, central, and then southern. And we would essentially, the money would go to staffing and to increase our impact by having more people, more boots on the ground, if you will.
Thank you, Madam.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. My question's for the author. The Commissioner of Health shall award the grants. Given the targets that we saw yesterday, where in the dickens is that money going to come from?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Considine, that's a great question. It'll be part of the larger discussion, Health and Human Service Finance, as to where these funds come from.
Representative Considine?
So that's an I don't know?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Considine, you could describe it as that, yes.
Representative Considine?
No more questions. Thank you.
Okay. Then we'll move on to our next testifier. And Ms. Shetley, if you would identify yourself, and welcome.
This is actually Sue Shetley here. I'm Dr. Lisa Mattson.
Oh, I'm sorry. Then Dr. Lisa.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Dr. Lisa Mattson. I'm a gynecologist at the University of Minnesota and also the past president of the Twin City Medical Society. I think all physicians have their stories about life and death experiences with our patients. And any of you who study the New York Times, you will see that for the last 8 weeks, Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, has been number one on the bestseller list. So this is a very timely subject talking about end-of-life care. I could tell plenty of stories, but I want to talk to you more as an individual and a daughter and how that's actually shaped my career. My own mother lost her battle to breast cancer when she was 36 years old. She left me and my dad and my two younger sisters. When she was first diagnosed with her cancer, she did everything she could. She did surgery, she did chemo. The chemo was very difficult for her. 2 years after her original diagnosis, she was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer. And she was a smart enough woman to ask, can this be cured? She was told that this was definitely a terminal illness. Doing any treatment would potentially prolong her life, but she'd have up days and many down days. And for her, she decided that for every day that chemo might keep her alive, she'd spend that day being sick, and she didn't want that. She also didn't want to die in a nursing home or in a hospital. So we had the summer with her that year, and she had time with her family. She got to meet with her parents, see her brothers and sisters, and she had peace. Our family had time with her and closure, and everyone was okay with her decision. She ended up dying at home, and the day before she died, she went to a Tupperware party, which was wonderful. My youngest sister was 6 at the time. She doesn't remember my mom being in a lot of pain and being really sick. Her memories are of a healthy woman. And the discussions my mom had with her doctor and with us as families, I think, really helped everyone in our family deal with this horrible situation much better. Later on in my life, just a few years ago, I had an uncle who, in his 70s, was in a head-on collision outside of Mankato. And after being in this collision, he was sent to the hospital. He suffered many strokes and heart attacks and ultimately was not able to communicate anything to his children. His children have tried to make the best decisions they could, but they have agonized, wondering if doing all the things they've done was the right thing. They wonder if he's had the quality of life that he would want. They've had to sell his house in order to pay his medical bills, and he's spent a majority of the last 3 years of his life in a hospital setting. Discussions with family before crises occur are very important and can save people a lot of emotional angst in situations that are already difficult. I do not want you all to think that honoring choices and end-of-life discussions are all about stopping treatment and not doing anything. In Gawande's book, he tells a very lovely story of a man with a spinal cord tumor that was going to kill him if they didn't do anything. His daughter talked to him because if they did surgery, there would be a strong possibility of death or paralysis of all four of his limbs. And when asked about what he wanted for his life, his response was simply that as long as he could eat chocolate ice cream and watch football, that was enough life for him. And knowing that, his daughter was able to make appropriate decisions, and it made it easier for him as she took care of him throughout the next several months. Honoring Choices is a wonderful program. Minnesota has always led the way in healthcare. Honoring Choices has been here for the last 6 years. We simply want to take our message out to a larger portion of the state of Minnesota so that more families can have these discussions before there's a problem. So I encourage you all to go home tonight and talk to your families after you've passed these bills. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Mattson. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Representative Schumacher or whoever we need to redirect it to. I notice on lines 3.15 and 3.16 we mention the financial impact of state health care costs, but I'm not seeing any mention of in the process of this discussion of also involving financial planning, and you really need to have coordination of the financial planning and the advanced care directives in a family for things to really go smoothly. In some cases, if you're talking about, not only to pay for care, but also that advanced financial planning if you have someone who suffers from dementia or Alzheimer's or other debilitating conditions and, you know, that smooth kind of handoff of finances to other family members. So I know it's touchy, you know, to combine health discussions with money discussions. But if we don't do that, it just ends up being harder when you are forced to do it. So I'm wondering why that's missing from the list of things to talk to people about.
Dr. Gephardt.
Yes, I'll try to answer that. We started some of our discussions over a year ago with the commissioners of health and Human Services and Lucinda Jensen actually felt that this activity fell really into Own Your Own Future concept, and did see the connection between planning for your future in a responsible way. It is a touchy subject. Our goal is not to save money. The outcome of a good discussion with patients and families and having decisions made that reflect what the patient would want done has shown in several studies to actually achieve what we call the triple aim of increasing value and reducing cost and improving the quality of care at the end of life. So there is data to show that care at the end of life, especially for the state-funded population in medical assistance, is very expensive, more expensive than other payers, and I think it will have a beneficial impact.
Thank you, Dr. Kappert. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Yaruso. The savings portion there is a conversation that is reported back to the legislature. That's the conversation that we're having here. The lines that you were referring to are in the report that goes back to the legislature. So I'm hoping that helps a little bit with.
Representative Yaruso.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Schubacher, I realize that. Okay. I was just pointing out that we mention it from our point of view, you know, but fail to mention it from the family's point of view. And I would be happy if there were a simple phrase put in here somewhere of, you know, coordinating financial planning. And it doesn't have to be in any greater detail than that, but I think it would at least open the door to that conversation being part of what people do. Doesn't mean that the people offering these services have to be financial planners, you know, but I think it would be really good if we acknowledge it up front, because then we could include that in the discussion. And it's not necessarily just about long-term care policies or something like that. I mean, there's simple things, and I'm coming at this from a perspective of having seen it go really well in my mother's case, you know, where she had all of the trusts and things she needed to have set up. She had the power of attorneys that she needed to have set up. She had me on the checking account, and I smoothly transitioned into helping her with her bills, you know, and all of that. And that aspect couldn't have gone better for us, and I would just hope that could happen for more people. Thanks.
Representative Schumacher, do you have any comments? Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just had kind of a comment, because Dr. Mattson, your story about your mother and your uncle and kind of the difference, it just really made me think about the parallel between what we're talking about here, which is kind of empowering the individual to make their own choice, whatever that might be, and not imposing our value judgment upon them, and what we're trying to do in the area of services for people with disabilities, where we have something that actually started in the southeast corner of the state to do our licensing services differently for people with disabilities, so that it's not so much about what somebody else thinks is quality, it's more about what that individual thinks is quality, and then trying to go from there to fix what they care about and not spend money on stuff they don't care about. And I just think there's a real parallel here, and it's a nice one, and that we, with advances in technology, and that if we don't allow those technologies to overwhelm us and kind of keep our eyes on what that individual thinks is important to them, that we can do a whole lot better, probably for a whole lot less money. So it just comes together very nicely, I think, with the way that I hope this legislature is moving. And just so members know, there's a bill, I think Representative Hamilton is carrying it, for the statewide quality council, and this has to do with people with disabilities, but it's to try to implement statewide this process of doing what are called voice reviews, which is talking to the individuals involved and saying, are you getting what you need from your services, instead of just looking at, you know, are we meeting certain rules about what the bureaucracy thinks quality would look like. So this is really, it's a great idea. I hope we're able to do something along these lines.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify to this bill? Any questions from the members? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to go into my personal stories, but I have quite a few dealing with this issue and being with family when they're dying. But I really hesitate to encourage financial counseling with healthcare counseling. I realize there's a real interlock there and the concerns that we have, but I think this is a serious conversation. It is very difficult when you make those choices and when you've been asked to make those choices for family. But I think the finances have to be a separate conversation and should not necessarily be entwined with our healthcare choices. There is a definite reality about the choices we make when we have end-of-life decisions made. But I'm just not comfortable talking about encouraging both end-of-life decisions and then the financial decisions with it. So, and I just, you know, it's a very sensitive conversation, and there's a lot of different scenarios that happen. So, and I can guarantee you the choices are difficult, whether you've had that conversation or you have not. And I've been in both of those situations. And it's challenging, and it is costly. So thank you.
Representative Schumacher, any final comments?
No, please support the bill.
Representative Schumacher renews his motion that House File 970 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 970 is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. And now, Representative Schumacher moves House File 971 to be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill before us. Representative Schumacher, anything you want to say?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just a different approach to the bill, just a direct appropriation. That's my motion.
Do we have any further comments? Representative Newton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schumacher, you know, given that we are cutting over $1 billion from Health and Human Services, what else do you propose cutting in order to pay for this?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Newton. That's a discussion for the Finance Committee.
Follow up, Representative Newton. Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was going to be not quite as direct as that one, but despite the fact that this isn't a Finance Committee, we're having to balance priorities. And we're having a bit of indigestion on this side of the table here. We've had some really ambitious proposals move through this committee, and there's a feeling that it's all for naught, given the targets that were issued yesterday. And so we're kind of wondering which of these things we've been working so hard on is going to be the top priority for you. That's really the question. Which of these, you know, is this the top priority? Is the HF 316 the top priority? Or is the nickel and diming of all the, you know, this county and that county the top priority? So where are we going with this? There's no dollar amount on this, so we have no idea how this stands relative to any of the rest of the stuff we've done. So in spite of this not being the Finance Committee, the question is, is our work on this committee since January going to amount to anything? And which things can we trust are going to be the top priority going forward that we're going to fight for when we get in with those targets?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Urusso. It's my understanding with the one group that has approached me about this particular grant, the one that's in front of us today, that the appropriation, there isn't a set amount that they would need in order to start the expansion. That there is that basically anything, if they were to get anything, they would be able to work with it and to be able to advance that here. And that's why there isn't an appropriation amount set in the funds there.
Representative Caruso, a follow-up?
No, thanks.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. having gone through this twice last month, I know how valuable it is. My mother was very clear. We knew exactly, and she named me the person to make the decisions because she knew my father would vacillate. After she was gone, my father, who was only within the last few months that he even acknowledged that it was possible that he might die. So we really had no idea what it would come down to. So he, luckily we didn't have to make any of those decisions at his time. I think it's a great bill, but I also think that you've been bamboozled if you think it's going to go forward. I just don't see where the money's going to be coming from. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Representative Considine. Any comment? Representative Schumacher?
No.
Representative Liebling? Oh. Any further questions? Anyone else that wants to testify on the bill? Seeing none, Representative Schumacher renews his motion that House File 971 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 971 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you all. Okay. Now, if Representative Mahoney wants to make his way down here, and while he's doing that, I will move House File 1699 to be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance. We have the bill before us. Representative Mahoney, when you get settled.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is an OSHA bill, Minnesota OSHA bill. It clarifies the use of how they track occupations from a Minnesota numbering system to a national NAS code identification number. Requires nursing homes and hospitals to provide nurses and other care providers the proper training in lifting patients and be trained in the use of life equipment. It builds on the Safe Patient Handling Act, which was passed about 8 years ago bipartisanly. Should hopefully reduce the number of work comp claims from hospitals and nurses. So that's why it has to go to jobs, because it is it affects the Department of Labor and Industry. I have at the discretion of the chair, I could fix it with a written amendment, but I have a small oral amendment, if you would be so kind, is on page 1, line 8. The second set of numbers, the numbers are, there's one extra one in there. And so it reads, of 62210, comma, 6222110, on that last number, it should read 622210. And that would be an oral amendment, and if you're okay with that, I'll do it here. Otherwise, we can do it in the Jobs Committee.
We can do it here.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members
well,
of the...
Well, if we could just have House Research say back to us what the oral amendment will be.
Madam Chair, the oral amendment will be page 1, line 8,
delete 622210 and insert 622210.
Does that sound right, Representative?
That's perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to vote for it.
All those in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The oral amendment is added.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's what the bill does, pretty much. I brought John Rakowski, the government relations person from the Department of Labor and Industry, to either if there's any questions that I have left in your mind.
Mr. Rakowski, welcome to the committee. And if you just want to state your name for the record and any comments you have.
My name is John Rakowski. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Government Relations for the Department of Labor and Industry. This bill came to us from one of our OSHA specialists who felt that there were some healthcare providers, quote, falling through the cracks, if you will, who aren't necessarily getting properly trained in safe patient handling. And we've worked at looking at healthcare facilities, and we've worked with the Leading Edge and other groups, and we decided we don't want to take the approach of singling out like group homes or assisted living homes. That just didn't work. Instead, we looked at the actual occupation duties that they have as the on the job. So if a healthcare provider's job is to be involved with safe patient handling, then they'd be required to be trained in the proper use of safe patient handling and also required to have lift equipment. The training, I understand, is online, so it's pretty painless. And also doing some just anecdotal research. A lot of group homes here, at least in the Twin Cities that I know of, they're already doing it. If you've got patients in a group home who require to have assistance being lifted out of their wheelchairs, et cetera, the folks who own these places are doing it already. So it's also, it was pointed out in the Senate that it's also, we're not just looking at the reducing injuries for the workers, but also the patients themselves or the residents can be injured too if they're not properly lifted. So it's a good win-win. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rakowski. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Are there any member questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just so I understand, does this bring in more facilities that wouldn't be included under the original definitions? Is that what it's doing? Sorry, I'm just a little confused about what the effect of this.
Representative Levy, Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Mr. Rakowski.
That's been a question that we've had with the stakeholders. And my answer, and I do have our OSHA specialist here, is it depends. There are some, if you have a facility where you have residents or patients who don't require to have assistance in lifting, then it wouldn't be required. So it depends on whether or not the patients or the residents require assistance in safe patient handling. So some might and some might not.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just so I'm understanding what this is doing, so this isn't changing the definitions for purposes of anything except the safe patient handling part of law, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I believe that's right, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions? Representative Gunther.
I had a question for Mr. Rakowski. Is it possible for a nursing home facility to access patient lifts of various kinds to prevent injuries from labor and industry?
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, thank you very much for bringing that up. That's an important part of our department. Is we have, as part of our OSHA consultation program, what's called the Assigned Risk Safety Account. It's a safety grant program, so businesses and units of government or institutions can apply for a grant of up to $10,000 to purchase safety equipment.
Thank you.
I encourage you to tell your constituents that because it's a really good program. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rakowski.
Thanks for the plug, Mr. Chairman.
My softball for the day.
Representative Mahoney, do you have any comments?
Ready to go, vote for it.
Thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 1699 to be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 1699 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Lee.
We kind of seem like we're at a point in between the bills now and then kind of transitioning to some presentations. I just have a couple comments I'd like to make, if I can, or questions for the Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yesterday, the Speaker Dowd came out with the House position on the budget, and we all noticed that there's pretty massive cuts to the Health and Human Services budget of $1.1 billion, even though we're in a time that we have a surplus that we're looking at. And I'm pleased to hear that the Speaker's committed to Chair Schumacher's bill, but it didn't sound like to me, I didn't hear him say that he was fully committed to it. So that, quite honestly, made me a little nervous that we were going to live up to kind of a, it seemed like there was pretty unanimous support here for your bill, Mr. Chair, and then the 5% bill that we heard that Representative Hamilton and Representative Newton worked so hard on, and others, of course. But I just didn't get the feeling that, you know, even after that robust, lively debate, you know, that we just, you know, and when the budget targets came out, we just didn't see that, the 5%, and then now hearing that we're not doing, or maybe not fully doing yours. So that concerns me.
You want me to get to that?
Mr. Chair, as we, you know, I know we're looking at the, you know, somehow we've got to figure out this nursing home situation. We all, you know, we were blessed by the trip you took, you know, took us on, and we all saw the need. And I don't know if you've had a chance to meet Helen yet. No, I'm sorry. I just couldn't resist to bring her up one more time. But the quality care, you know, component, and we need to, you know, pay folks. And I know you didn't support the 100%, but we did kind of seem like we came to some sort of consensus around increasing the pay for folks that are offering these services. And I really hope that you, as you move forward, that you continue to work with Speaker Dowd and then the Chair, Dean, as he comes with targets and to fight for these. I have a couple questions for you, Chair. I don't know if it's me or who or what. You know, I know this isn't a finance committee, and you keep bringing that up, and but I always think of Governor Anderson, and I don't know if you ever heard of him. He was a Republican governor. My family owns a bunch of newspapers, so I always took an interest in him, and you know, he had a lot to do with different, you know, as a governor, but also just I always felt that he was a true lover of the state. And what he always looked at budgets, he didn't always look at numbers. So you've continually said, well, we're not really a finance committee. I get that. But he's said repeatedly, let's figure out what the needs are. So when I think of Helen again, and I think of seniors or people needing care, I think of them needing services. So I don't necessarily think of number. I think of policy. So how are we going to keep Minnesotans as they age, and if they're in home care, and how are we going to keep them safe? So, and then the next question, obviously, later. So we, as a policy committee, decide that that's a priority, and then we, you know, but I think that money should follow, you know, things, obviously, to pay for it. I mean, you can't have, you know, those discussions. But, you know, here we are. You know, you've got this surplus. So it is somewhat embarrassing, I think, for us as a committee and as a state, if we're not able to achieve some of this. And then, you know, and I think offline you would probably agree, and I'm not going to ask you if you do or not. But, you know, so you've got this surplus, and then at the same time we've got this negative cut target in the Health and Human Services. So I'm just curious, you know, are you committed to the fully, to the full, you know, to the Hamilton bill and to yours, I guess would be my question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lilly. We're going to keep working at it. Their priority is the fine, like I mentioned last week. There's not much else I get to work on these days than those efforts. And I think in the press conference yesterday, it was the targets were talked about how the House File 316 would be a part of that. And what form that takes in the end, I'm not exactly sure how those will look. We are in the process of getting fiscal notes now for that House file to see where things are at and what needs to be done in there, where we go from there. And so we're working on that as well as what the 5% campaign will look like and working with Representative Hamilton to see what he as the author would like to see done there.
Mr. Chair and to Mr. Chair.
Representative Lilly.
Not exactly sure how to, sometimes it's a little juggling, but it was a little easier with Madam Chair and then Mr. Chair. But Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair. Yeah, thank you. I really think you got to get in there and scrap. You know, you're a super nice guy, and at some point, you know, you've got to roll up those sleeves you know, I've seen your tough side. I teased him one day about, something about 10,000 all the communities that he has in his district of 10,000 folks, and he's like, well, so I know you can tease and you can fight, and because you've given me a couple sharp elbows on that one, because apparently you don't have very many 10,000 communities in your district, as in zero. Is that correct? My apologies. But so, and please get out there and fight. I just think it's an important subject, obviously, for Minnesota, and we all get that. I just want to thank you for it's been a good committee. Your staff's been great. The House staff's been good, but it's been very interesting. But please get out there and fight. We're all getting. You're still young, but Bobby and I are getting.
You're young.
We're getting close. Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wish I was as young as you are. But anyway, there's a lot of ways to know. The governor gave zero to assisted living also. And we have a lot of things to fall back and hope for. We can go through budgets. I don't know about the Health and Human Services budget. I'd have to defer to Representative Liebling. She's certainly more knowledgeable about that. But the jobs budget, when plenty cut sales off and several things that I really favored that were money for vulnerable people, after he promised he wouldn't, I started sweeping the floor and looking at places and corners and cracks and find out underutilized monies that we could take from those and give to the things that we had as a higher priority for this day. And that's something that we can do, and I'm sure Chairman Schumacher will be looking at things like that. And then we have another really funny thing that's really helpful in our government. It's called the Senate. The Senate is the most creative body in the world as far as finding money. They take money out of places we thought were sacred, that you couldn't do it. And it's amazing what they can come up with. I'm sure you saw that various times, Representative Liebling. It's a very creative thing. So to say there's no hope is not right. To say it's our budget is not right, because the governor doesn't have it either. We have to determine our priorities, and we'll do a good job of that. I have confidence in the people in this committee to do that. But to give up hope and say we aren't going to fund that, if we start going around with a defeatist attitude like that, I promise you won't be funded. But remember, there's always a Senate, and there's some pretty creative people there.
Members, we have groups that have traveled a long way to give a 15 to 20 minute presentation. One more question, I think. Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. Since my name was mentioned, thank you, Representative Gunther. I just wanted to correct one thing that you said, and that is about the governor not doing anything on this topic. In fact, in his supplemental budget, there is, I think, $25 or $35 million that would be directed right to raising the wages of people who work in nursing facilities. So I think his explanation for his starting position on this and doing less than the House was planning to do is that we did, in fact, do a lot in this area over the last couple of years. It wasn't enough. We all know that. But we, in fact, did prioritize this area, not only the nursing facilities, but the home and community-based services. So in recognition of that, he did more on the children and family side in his budget and less on this side. But in fact, he did, in his supplemental budget, put some money toward this very thing to not leave behind these workers that we are all very concerned about. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very quickly, Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, just on the same thought, 100% he offered for encumbrances for the employees. So I just good thinking by the governor there.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ardolph. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Tom Ardolph from a company, Cybermation, out of Wake Park. And let's see, I'm here. I did provide a folder to you with a bunch of information, and I'm going to do things a little bit differently maybe here this morning. I brought along a suitcase of some things. I don't know if some of you watch, remember Carrot Top that's on TV where he kind of runs to the suitcase and gets something out and shows you some things. So I'm no red hair here, so I'm maybe not Carrot Top, but maybe more Chrome Dome or something like that.
Representative Urso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we please ask him to use the mic because this is a public hearing after all?
Okay. All right. I'm going to grab this right here.
Thank you, Mr. Ardo.
All
right. If a watermelon comes out of there, I'm moving.
Okay.
Run comedian. Oh.
All right. My company, Cybermation, provides digital healthcare technologies. And so this morning, we formed our company. I've actually been in the technology business for about 30 years. And since 2009, I got involved primarily with technology to help seniors stay in their home. And I've really grown that business to not only be for seniors staying in their home, but also many of the same technologies can help the disabled and disadvantaged individuals. And so I talk a little bit about that. The literature that I gave to you right here, since I surely don't have enough time in 20 minutes to cover everything I'd like to talk about, we'll give you a little bit of reading information. Surely nobody here, this technology doesn't apply to you today, but I'm sure most of you have been in a caregiving situation sometime, likely, in the last few years. You know, if it's mom, dad, grandpa, grandma, somebody like that, you've literally had to be a caregiver. In fact, lady that will be speaking to you told me that 94% of caregiving is literally done by individuals in a non-paid basis. And so that's you and I. And so what I really have here are things that really my primary goal, if I could do one thing, one sentence, would be to help seniors stay in their home longer. Just out of coincidence, inside of the folder, we were literally in the St. Cloud Times just this past week. We won a national award for from the Consumer Electronics Association, actually, for a health and wellness project of the year. And oddly, it was a project that Aiken County spent about $1,700 for. And I'll tell you what happened. Now, and this wasn't a senior, but it was a lady that was in a group foster home setting, and they were paying, the county rate was $160 a day. We provided technology with a total cost of about $1,700. Half of that was the annual subscription, and she moved into her own apartment, and her mom's words are she is absolutely thriving. So $160 a day, $1,700 a year. Those are the types of equations that are just very, very compelling, I think, when we start to talk about technology. There's two things in your folder. One, the importance of telehealth and the return on investment from home-assisted technology. And I won't go through that, but the proof has been made time and again and again about the benefits of technology. We aren't here to replace caregivers in any way, shape, or form. Instead, we're here to try to help the caregiving process. But there's also things that get done through that caregiving process that technology can be a tremendous asset. You know, the most common one, likely, if you've been in the caregiving situation, is how many times do you run by to see how mom and dad is? And we know how that works, is the person that lives closest to mom or dad goes and sees them. And then when that person can't go and see them, the person that lives second closest to them goes and sees them. And then when both of those people are on vacation, it's the third person and so on. And everybody loves their parents. I'm going to guess everybody sitting around the table here loves their parents, and they would be more than happy to do that. But do that for 3 months, then do it for 6 months, and then do it for a year or two. It's a very stressful thing to be able to do something like that. And so we believe that there's a wide array of technologies, actually, that are out there that I want to talk about right here. And some of them are basic devices. And literally what I want to show you are things that are off the shelf, literally available, things that we're working with right now, really for your informational purposes, and we'll pass some of those things around. And then we'll talk about a couple different systems that I work with. And I'm really going to kind of delineate. There's two different primary things. One is that telehealth, telemedicine, and there is a couple bills open right now, I believe HF 1246 and a couple Senate bills that are really out there to address the telemedicine component of using technology to help care for people in general, seniors of course. And the other thing though that we can do is monitor activities of daily living, and those are called ADLs. And I'm going to give you a scenario that I bet really would apply to many people that you may know. And if we can literally know what people are doing on a daily basis, record that, create a baseline, compare that, and when an anomaly takes place, let a caregiver know. Now, with my mother, I'm going to guess that I would know where she would be at 10 o'clock in the morning. Wheel of Fortune. Oh, excuse me, Price is Right. I stand corrected. But 6:30, we know where mom and dad's sitting in the chair. Wheel of Fortune. We know typically that someone's going to sleep maybe from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. And if something happens in between there, that would be an anomaly. A good example is this, is a person gets up, goes to the bathroom, falls, doesn't return back to bed. Now, we could let that person lay on the floor for hours or days at a time, or if we had predictive technology that said that person normally sleeps from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., and if they don't get back into bed during that time, alert a caregiver. And so we can do many, many different types of things by monitoring those activities of daily living to be able to do that. Now, the reality is this. If I took a poll here right now and asked everyone for a show of hands, do you think that, A, there's going to be more technology in the caregiving process, or B, less technology in the caregiving process? I mean, I think everybody knows it's going to be more. So it's really how are we going to do it, not if we're going to do it. That being the case, the challenge is, it's really a challenge, because one of the problems with the customers that I work with, because I work both with individuals, but just as likely I work with organizations, enterprises, caregiving organizations, and those people have a real challenge. You know, the things that you're talking about here, the 5% bill that you have in front of you, I mean, those are challenges because there's only so much money to be able to pay those people. Not only that, most of those people will tell you there's not enough people. So if there's not enough people and there's not enough money, how can we change that equation? We have to introduce a whole new paradigm in the caregiving equation to be able to do that. And that is very, very possible. The problem is this, the technology is there. I have it here for you to show it to you. The problem is this, is do they literally take something that if they start implementing some of those technologies, they lose revenue because it's not a reimbursable service that they can provide, or do they keep going down basically the same road trying to provide caregiving through the traditional role of the human touch? And there is a balance. I'm not here to eliminate caregivers. I'm here to help caregivers. And so those are the challenges that we face all of the time, both especially, you know, Representative Liebling brought that up about the issue of money. We do have to talk about those things, and we have to find ways to both save money, and frankly, most of these organizations need to find a way to make money to be able to keep them as a prospering entity so they can stay in business to care for, you know who? You and I. Because before you know it, we're the next ones up in line. And so we want something in place to be able to do that. So let me just kind of pass some things around. I think this gentleman was going to do this for me. I mean, these are the types of things, literally, these are basic devices. These devices right here are all cellular-based technologies right now. And, you know, the first one, the silver one that you can look at right there, literally you can wear it as a watch, you can wear it around your neck. And we literally will then know when you come or go from home, if something happens, you push a button, it calls directly to an emergency call response place. These are the types of technologies that I'm employing on a day-to-day basis. I bet everybody here knows what this means. I'm falling and I can't get up. We've all heard the ad. But most of our seniors today are actually tethered to their home to an I'm falling and I can't get up life alert type system, because they go outside of the home, the system ceases to work. The devices that I'm passing around to you here right now are all cellular-based technologies that if they push that button, I don't care if they're in their home, I don't care if they're at the Mall of America, I don't care if they're at Disneyland or Disney World, those devices work. And the seniors want that type of stuff. They want to be a little bit more empowered to allow them to be outside of their home. Because statistically, 89% of people still want to be in their home, basically, until the day they die. And so if I can do that, I feel that I've been successful in what I do. I know my time is going to be short right here, so I just want to grab a few more things. Now, what happens is, for instance, is as those people progress, could be early stages of dementia, I'll pass this around, basic watch-based technology. This is off-the-shelf technology right now. Inside of that, as well as inside of this one right here, if you want to go to the other side right there, both of those have cellular technology built into those. We know at any given time where the person is at wearing that watch. As a matter of fact, we put a boundary around where they're supposed to be, and if they break that boundary, we can get an immediate alert to be able to do that. So this is the stuff that is off the shelf, and I literally use these for people that are in caregiving organizations. So if they elope, go through the door of a place, somebody's pushing buttons up there, Mr. Chairman.
So mature.
But with very, very simple technologies, we can literally empower our seniors to be able to live in their home safely and securely. And when you go to see your mom and dad, you can go to see them because you're the loving son and daughter, not because you need to sneak in and find out how they're doing on a daily basis. So in the short time that I have left right here, we go beyond individual devices, and sir, you wanted to pass this around, you will see that this system right here, completely encapsulated cellular technology right here, some of them are broadband technology, you'll see that there isn't even a power switch. There isn't even a power switch on these systems anymore. We need to tell them that everything's okay here. I don't think this is an emergency right now. We're in a House representative session in Minnesota, and we're just demonstrating your technology. Thank you.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to make sure, because you dialed in and then hung up on us. Just to reconfirm, is everybody safe and out of danger?
Everybody is safe and out of danger, are they not? Yes, yeah. Sir, they are. Thank you.
Everything is working for me.
You'll also see that these things work inside buildings. And when we push that button, they knew where we were at. You know, that's the important thing. So wherever our seniors are, they can get immediate response. If I wouldn't have answered, I'll tell you what would have happened. An ambulance actually would have, and a policeman would have showed up in this location because we pushed that button right there. So just to go, you know, for the 5 minutes that we have right here, those devices right there, white box technology, it requires no technology to do it. Everything goes to the internet, and so what that allows us to do is we start to embed sensors. It could be something as simple as this chair pad, and that's the chair pad that we're going to know if mom's in her chair for Wheel of Fortune and Price is Right. We make that a little bit bigger, we put it in her bed, and then we know that if she is in or out of bed. We'll give her a little wristband like this. She pushes that, and she'll get a call just like we had right there. We put this little magnet on the garage door. Mom's not supposed to drive anymore, but she insists on keeping dad's car in the garage. This will tell us and give me a call if mom opens the garage door. We can also put this on the pill drawer. And if she doesn't open the pill drawer by 9 o'clock, it'll literally call her and say, Mom, you're supposed to take your pills. And if by 9:30 she doesn't take the pills, it calls me and says, Mom didn't take her pills. And so a wide array of these technologies, commercially available, off-the-shelf technology, literally available to keep our seniors safe and secure. This is one maybe you've seen before, I think, with someone that was here about a week ago. This actually is an unused enuresis pad that literally, if somebody has incontinence, we literally actually commonly use this in facilities to literally reduce the cost of caregiving in an organ in a facility, because now we don't have to go and check a person every couple hours to ensure that they haven't wet themselves, frankly. And we cut the cost, and we also generally change their drug regime as a result of not having to put them back together, put them back to bed and sleep again after we've woken them up to check on them. So in addition to that, the final thing that I just want to talk about right here is vital sign monitoring. This is the more sophisticated one that I have. It includes a little touch screen. Literally, this allows them to see the kids' pictures. It gives them a calendar. It gives them their prescription information, alerts them to taking their medications. But not only this, all of your vital sign monitoring goes through this device right here. And so it goes through this, goes to the cloud, and we set thresholds to be able to monitor what their vital signs are supposed to be. And automatically, if they are out of range, we let a caregiver, generally a medical professional, know about that. The point of this has really been the progress that we've seen with the ACOs, the Accountable Care Organizations, the ability to start to reduce readmissions to hospitals. Because you're going to see healthcare change from a very fee-for-based methodology all the way to health and wellness that will literally move directly into the individual homes. And so, I mean, that's where I have literally seen. The next big thing, literally, that we're looking at is a lot of wearable technologies, because those wearable technologies can give us information daily, hourly, more frequently, because challenges such as diabetes and CHF and COPD are the things that are costing our medical systems so much money, can literally be monitored, and a lot more preventative care can take place as a result of that. So,
Mr. Chair?
That's all I have.
Representative Considine?
I was just going to say we've got two other people that are wanting to do presentations, and we're starting to cut into their time.
Very good. That's all I have. Any questions?
Representative Considine, we're giving each group 15 minutes. His ends at 9:30.
It's 9:30.
That's all I have, unless anyone has any questions.
All Representative right. Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and not for the presenter, but I'm just wondering why we're doing this. It almost seems to me like kind of an infomercial that we're hearing here. I just don't recall ever in a committee getting presentations from an individual company about how wonderful their products are. And I think a lot of us are familiar with this kind of technology, and nothing about that or against them in particular. I'm just really surprised that we're giving committee time to this. And just wonder, Mr. Chair, I don't know these other two groups that are coming up, but is there a policy, something that's moving through, that this is giving us information about something specific? There's no bill here. And I'm just kind of wondering why we're doing this.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling. Several of these groups had requested before to come in and just bring just expose us to the technologies. I haven't been as aware of these technologies before. It wasn't intended to be an infomercial type thing. It actually dovetails a little bit with Representative Newton's bill from last week on providing grants for these things. But this was intended just to be kind of an information-based what is out there type of thing.
Representative Considine.
I don't know about the next one, but the final one, Vine is not a business. They are a faith-based organization that provides wonderful services in Mankato.
Members, any other questions?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, and, you know, more for Chair Schumacher. I mean, I appreciate that you want it, you know, more for Chair Schumacher. I mean, I appreciate that you want to educate the committee, but I really do think it's inappropriate to use the committee to give a particular business an opportunity to come in and hawk their products. And, you know, even though there's no immediate sale that's going to be made here, obviously, to the extent this is televised or, you know, broadcast to the state, we're basically giving somebody a great commercial opportunity for free to come in and make their pitch. And I'm sure that if you put out an RFP and gave an opportunity to say what businesses in Minnesota, I'm sure there'd be a lot of takers. And so I don't know, you know, why the particular organization and the next one got chosen, but I just really want to put on the record that I think it's not appropriate to allow committee time to be used in this way. We're kind of a captive audience. I mean, I know we can get up and leave. Most of us don't like to do that when presenters are here and have come from distance and so on, and we kind of depend on the chair to make sure that what we're hearing is worth our time, and our time's all very valuable. And I just want to put that on the record, Mr. Chair. I really think it's very unfortunate, and since I assume this is our last meeting, you know, usually we kind of have a nice saying goodbye at the end, and you know, I'm kind of playing with, am I really going to sit through the rest of this if it's going to be pretty much just, you know, this kind of commercial pitches? And glad to hear from Representative Considine that the last group at least is not.
Mr. Ardle, thank you for your what I think was a very worthwhile presentation on some of the advances in technology and how that's able to improve the lives of our aging seniors in Minnesota. I'd like to welcome some folks from B. Blumen. Welcome back. You were here last week for Representative Newton's bill. Please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Joel Ackerman. I'm the founder, CEO of River Systems is the company. B. Blumen is the service, and it's also a DBA that we filed, so we use that as the company name too. I heard your comments, and I will try to address this as in the context of Minnesota innovation. This is a homegrown Minnesota thing that is unique. It is nothing. There's nothing like it in the country, and I will try and keep it very much away from a sales pitch. So I did return today from the American Society on Aging conference going on in Chicago. There's a lot of focus on aging technologies and other things too, but really the awareness of the age wave and the needs of new and improved ways of doing things. Let me see, we are having a little bit of a connector problem. I apologize, technology is not my forte. Let me back up and say I've been in information technology for over 40 years. I'm the former CIO, international CIO, and Director of Advanced Technologies for United Health Group. I was at Honeywell for many years, GE Capital, Jelco Corporation, actually. And I've been a consultant to major healthcare and other organizations in healthcare. We may not be getting a signal. If this totally craps out, I'll just I'll speak, and hopefully you'll see the value of what we're doing. B. Blumen is, as I said, it's a Minnesota innovation. This has been very quietly in development for the last 5 years. We have been testing in Buffalo, Wilmer, Dawson, and Hastings, working with some very non-traditional funding from the University of St. Thomas, from the Blandon Foundation, and from private investors. We are somewhat of a hybrid in terms of your last presenter was from a for-profit company. Your last, the ending one is from a nonprofit. We actually have two companies, a for-profit and a nonprofit. We just got 501c3 approval for the nonprofit organization. And these companies are working together to bring technology to aging and aging issues. We're really at the intersection, and I'm sorry again for the technology not showing up, but we're at the intersection of three very big, powerful trends, areas of trends. The demographic shifts, you're all aware of the age wave issues, the families being dispersed, people not being around to take care of parents like in old days, lots of changes with regards to demographics. With regards to health information technology, which is where I've focused for the last 25 years, there's a lot going on, and healthcare in general is under a lot of pressure with ACOs and other compensation changes and all kinds of things, a lot of innovation going on. Good news is that information technology, some of the things you just saw, as well as many other things, information technology is moving ahead. Things are better, faster, cheaper. Okay. What we've been doing is focusing on how do the technologies, the services come together to enable people to stay in their own homes as long as possible, or wherever they are, have as great an aging experience as possible. And we look at eight areas, and I think that might be in the handouts that you can see the eight areas that we look at. It's not just about healthcare. It's not just about safety sensors at home or monitoring. It involves the community. It involves family engagement and faith and all kinds of other things. And so we are actively deploying in Red Wing, Minnesota, and in Gaylord, Michigan, throughout Otsego County, Michigan, and we are about to start in Wadena, and we are looking at other communities too. The deployment of a community model that brings together a wide range of capabilities in a very simple, consumable format so that even seniors who never use a computer can use them. Okay. And again, I'll try and keep it non-commercial. It's not about what we're doing. It's about these things have to come together. If information technology or any technology is absorbed, is embraced, and this is what I learned in over 40 years in information technology, people learn to use technology if it is cheap enough, if it's supported, if it is the benefits are clear and compelling, if they feel safe using it, okay? And if all those things are addressed, then people embrace technologies. Seniors, all of them learned how to use a microwave oven at some level, a TV remote control at some level. It's because those things were addressed. And if we're going to get people to embrace technology, because technology can help stay, keep them connected, engaged, supported, all four have to be addressed. So what we've done is really focus, and actually there's five. I forgot what the fifth one is right now. But there's five areas that have to be addressed. So we're doing some very innovative things. In Wadena, Minnesota, we built the first of its kind anywhere in the world, as far as I know, a two-way video-based call center so that if mom or anybody needs help, whether it's using our system or other technologies or other kinds of organizations, at the touch of a button, somebody is live on screen, able to work with her, able to look her in the eye, see if she's understanding, if she needs help, and be a friendly face that can help. So remote support that's usable for our systems as well as for other purposes. We have made the system a single sign-on, single user ID, and once you log into it, you can use video calls with up to six people at a time, family, friends, doctors, nurses, whatever, clergy. You can engage them in a video call. You can send email messaging. You can click into streaming cameras all over the world. If you want to watch the Eagle's Nest in Minnesota and see the baby eagles there, you can do that. And, in fact, very soon you'll be able to take your grandkids anywhere in the world to be able to do this. What we're doing is integrating technology, making it consumable, making it cheap, or free. And actually, for consumers, this is free. Let's do that. That is? Okay. Go with that. Just to back up a step, what we're trying to do is make it so that people, individuals and families, are always supportively engaged and connected with all the people and organizations that are important to them. Okay? And we're trying to add meaning and quality to life. And that means that all the kinds of things that you just heard about with technologies, those have to be brought into the picture. Family social connectivity, social media, needs to be brought into the picture. Faith needs to be brought in the picture. In Red Wing, for example, we're working with two churches there. We're about to bring up four more in Gaylord, Michigan, including the diocese, the cathedral there. And people...
Mr. Ackerman?
Yes,
just... We have five more minutes, and I know we have one question from Representative Yaruso.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious, given this is aimed at seniors, what accommodations are made in your system for people with visual impairments? Does it follow the HTML Universal Design Guidelines, you know, so that it will read things to people, or how does it cope with that?
Thank you for the question. There are several ways that we've addressed that. One is it does follow the guidelines, and in fact, we do have a totally blind person in Michigan that is using the system, and he's given us good feedback and ideas about how to improve it. We've also run our user interface through analysis software that looks at it from the standpoint of various kinds of vision impairments, macular degeneration, color blindness, and we have the ability to have various presentations of the system tailored to the user based upon their individual needs.
Representative Urizo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since it's designed to do, you know, calendars and whatnot, is it able to take information from other common systems, you know, upload calendar appointments and things like that? Are they coming from somewhere else?
We're
Mr. Ackerman.
Yes, thank you. We are releasing it in stages. The calendar piece is in user testing now. It does not have the ability to import or interact with other calendars. That is on our design plan, though, so that will happen.
Representative Urizo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Mike, in addition to the design the universal design aspects, I'm wondering how well it's going to interface with the things that the family would want to share, you know, with someone, or whether it's going to add another layer of complexity because you can't get at those Facebook photos of the grandchild and, you know, that kind of thing. So that, no more detailed questions, but thanks.
Mr. Ackerman.
Yes. if you can see on the screen, that's just a screenshot of what it looks like. Again, large buttons. The assistance button is always there. If you hit that, somebody is live on screen, able to take you through or take over if you want them to, take over a remote control of your system. And this works on PCs and Macs. We are testing now the Android version for Android phones and Android tablets. We also have a version that we will start deploying next month that will enable any TV, even dumb TVs, to do this. So you'll be able to sit on the sofa, have a video call with your grandkids. Very soon you'll be able to take them to the National Zoo. They could be anywhere in the world. You'll be able to take them to the National Zoo and watch the pandas. So engage and interact. And similarly, organizations in the community, you'll be able to interact with. Part of our lessons learned from our prototypes that we deployed, the testing that we did in those communities I talked about, is that aging and having a good aging experience, and let me back up, because this is not just about aging, it applies to people in general, but focusing on aging, it's not just an individual issue, it's not a family issue, it's not an organizational issue, it's a community issue. And that's why we are deploying this in specific communities, rolling it out with the organizations in the community. So in Red Wing, for example, in a project funded by the city of Red Wing, the Mayo Hospital there, the Minskew College there, and another community fund, we're working with two churches, four senior housing locations, the senior center, the Sheldon Theater, which is a beautiful restored theater that's going
to
be live.
Mr. Ackerman, I apologize. We have to cut you off. I really appreciate you taking the time to come and present to us. I think we really learned a lot. Our next presentation is from Pam Dieterman from Vine Faith and Action.
Mr. Chair, as they're coming up, Vine Faith and Action is a faith-based organization, nonprofit, that keeps people in their homes. I believe Representative Gunther is also very familiar with them. They have partnerships, maybe I'm stealing some of her presentation, but with the Blue Earth County Sheriff's Office, they have the Corrections Department. They also offer volunteer opportunities, and I'm proud to say my children and I volunteered there for a couple of summers, cutting the lawn for one of our elderly neighbors. They get a tremendous bang for their buck also.
Well, hello. I'm happy to be here, and I have a whole new appreciation for your job and the work you do and the things that you are challenged to do on behalf of aging adults and frail people within our state. And I probably just to, as I'm the last presenter for the day, I just want to end on a really positive note of saying there are some wonderful things that are happening in the community, in our communities, and in our states. And the state of Minnesota and Department of Human Services and Health are helping us to do that. I'm not here to ask for money. There's no bills out there, but I'm pretty excited to share with you the kinds of things that can happen when communities join together to be of assistance to older friends and neighbors. Very quickly, we are now 20 years old. We're the oldest Faith in Action program in Minnesota. We're actually the largest in the nation. And I think that lots of people have asked why that's happened, and I think much of it has to do with the fact that Minnesota people are nice. We look out for one another, and in a community the size of Mankato, we've been able to bring in college students and people of lots of diversity to help. And we've also learned about the importance of developing partnerships, and some of those are listed on the PowerPoint. And to work with whoever is willing to work with us. Faith in Action is in our name, that we don't proselytize, and we work with people of many faith traditions or people who just simply believe in the importance of helping neighbors. Our funding comes from a variety of sources. Lots of fundraising, bake sales have been in our past and future. But also, we do receive some funding from the State of Minnesota Department of Human Services, which I'll tell you about. I've received two handouts. One is just a copy of our newsletter, which, you know, please take it home and read it and share it, because many, many good things are happening to help aging adults remain living in the community for as long as possible. But the other handout, and I know that you're getting bombarded with information, is one that actually comes from the Department of Health and Human Services, which are the statistics of what it costs to keep someone in their homes versus making that transition into long-term care and then ultimately into the public safety net. You know, those are the numbers that are up there in the presentation. By comparison, our cost, because of this intense volunteer support that we have about 550 adult volunteers and probably over 800 young people, you know, scouts, college kids, volunteers from the jail who are out on work release to help us. Our cost to work with an aging adult is about $500 a year. It's a significant difference, and I'm very proud of the fact that many of the people that we began caring for 20 years ago have had the opportunity to enjoy independent living with volunteer supports and some home care until the end of their lives. Obviously, we're a part of a continuum of care that, you know, people have a lot of needs, and there's definitely a place for nursing homes and assisted livings. But I think that it's very possible with the kind of support and kind of circling the wagons around people to extend the length of their community living and for a fraction of the cost. Pictures say 1,000 words. And I just wanted you to see a couple of those. Our impact is about 3,200 older adults each year whose lives we touch by just a variety of things. Rides to the doctor, taking their pet to the groomer, doing inside and outside chores. That woman on the bottom was able to, she died of a stroke last year and spent the last 2 weeks of her life in the hospital. But prior to that, we kept her at home, and I'm real proud of that. You've heard talk about the importance of caring for families, and you've heard testimony from even a couple of people here on your committee of the strain that happens in families as they're providing care. And we've designed a lot of services around being able to give support to family caregivers to lighten that load. And it's a wonderful time in life, but it's also a challenging time in life. And we do have a professional social worker and nurse on our staff, and we understand that and have found a lot of ways to help people in a very inexpensive way that is soft touch. You know, Meals on Wheels, identifying people who are challenged by losses in aging, and that might be loss of vision, it might be loss of a loved one, and matching them up with compassionate and caring volunteers to help them to navigate those challenges. But we've learned over the years that being able to age successfully has a whole lot more to do with being able to be at home and have clean windows to look out of or a ride to the doctor. Our philosophy really has, as we've morphed, is that growing older is not a disease, and we don't want to just define it as a disease. We want to be able to help people to understand and to enjoy their later years, and to be involved and to share their time in volunteerism and also in maintaining their own health and wellness for as long as they possibly can. And I'm really pretty proud of that. I do want to tell you one story because stories are important. The lady up in the upper right-hand corner with a really pretty smile and the white hair, I first met her. Her name is Doris. Met her in last August, so I haven't known her for very long. And she came to the Vine Adult Community Center, which had just opened, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But I met Doris in the lobby, and she said, you know, I did introductions, and within about 30 seconds, there was tears, and there was lots of tears. And it didn't take long for her to tell me the story of just having lost her husband within the last few months, and just how she had lost touch with anything that really kind of gave her a lot of joy during that season of her caregiving. And so if you could meet her now, or if I could have brought her along today, she would tell you how her life has been enriched by the social relationships and the health programs that, you know, that we've been able to offer in an informal basis in the Vine Adult Community Center. And probably as I talk about this, I would also say that before Vine moved from the volunteer service model to redefining senior centers, we did a lot of research. We traveled around the country and we looked at best practices as to what older adults want as they age, what helps them to age well. And one of the first things that we heard was language, and we know language is powerful. And in our organization, we have gotten rid of the S word. Anybody know what the S word is?
Sleep.
Oh yeah. No. Who had it? Senior. I heard that. We don't want to. Aging adults don't want to be labeled. If you're 55, you're a senior. If you're 99, you're a senior. There's three different generations in there. And to assume that we all like polka and bingo music is a joke. So we have worked very, very hard to look to see what are the things that people need and want. Back to Doris's story for just a second, because it's a really good one. When I met her, she said she had become so dependent on using her husband's toilet riser to get up and down that she had lost all physical strength. But now that she has been coming and being involved in the things that we do, she's vibrant and alive. She's volunteering and taking advantage of opportunities that we have for health and wellness. What Vine did in the greater Mankato area, a lot of people thought we were nuts. As we kept growing and growing and doing good in our community, we took over a senior center that was failing, and we flipped it. We got rid of bingo and polka music. Painted it bright colors, and all of a sudden and offered programming that was relevant and meaningful to a wide array of people. We grew from 50 people a week to 500 people a week using it. And so very boldly, just about 4 years ago, we went to our county government and said, hey, this building, the Nichols office building up on the upper left-hand corner of your screen, had been a former Mankato State College classroom building in the 50s, and it was about ready to be torn down because nobody wanted to buy it. And quite frankly, it's about a little bit older than I am, and I'm not ready for the landfill yet. So we went to the community. We went to a lot of private funders, no state funding or government funding. We raised about $3.95 million locally, and from foundations and individual donors. And again, we flipped a building and created an adult community center, which is a much different than the typical senior center model that you might have in your communities. Looking at the research that was done, that people, as they age, want to maintain their health, they want to continue to be useful, and to continue to learn and grow and make the best of their later years. You recognize that guy over there in the picture? Our governor came down and looked at our building. He tested out the new fitness equipment that we have with help from a state of Minnesota grant to buy, because the Department of Human Services recognizes that by keeping people healthy and well and active, they don't go down that slippery slope towards frailty and needing a more expensive level of care. Thanks to our local clinic, we have a walking track that goes around the circumference of the building that is actually made out of tires. It's a product called Retire. And we're just having a great time helping people stay healthy and well and engaged in life and out of long-term care. This is the end of my presentation, but what I want to end with on a positive note, because as I've listened to this meeting today, your job is tough. is I want to thank you. Some of you may not have been involved in the community services development grant process that's been around for about 10 years, but that competitive grant funds, which requires a dollar-for-dollar match from communities. So, and the people that issue the RFPs and review the grants really are thorough in making sure that that when those grants are awarded, that communities have their ducks in a row and that they deliver. But thanks to those grants and to a whole lot of other sources, we are doing our part in the greater Mankato area to slow the decline of people becoming frail, of keeping them healthy and helping them to not have to make that move into a more restrictive, customized, and expensive environment before it's asked to. On your program, you've got the information about the websites and the grants, and I got 3 minutes for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Dieterman.
Dieterman. You're welcome.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, is that whole building yours?
That whole building is ours.
So what else?
60,000 square feet.
So how many, what are different?
We have the first three floors, which is 36,000. And we continue to raise funds to put in a warm water exercise pool in the bottom. We're not there yet, but we're getting there. The fourth floor is all leased out to nonprofit organizations with missions similar to ours, which brings in some revenue. It also allows us to expand our services to adults with serious and persistent mental illnesses, to new Americans, and to a nonprofit hospice. The fifth floor, which has the most beautiful view of the Minnesota River Valley, we have just entered into an agreement with a local congregation. So they'll have a part of that floor, and we will build out the rest as community space because the building we got for a dollar. I don't know if I mentioned that, but yes. Yeah, we have a commitment to helping our community to have affordable options for gatherings and spaces like that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have about 10 seconds left, so very quickly, Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks. I just really wanted to thank you for coming, and it's really great to end this meeting and maybe this committee on such a nice positive note. And I mean, it's really a great vision for community and getting, it's not just about one group of people. It's about getting the whole community engaged, and that's beneficial for everybody. And I just feel very uplifted and inspired by your presentation. So thank you very much.
And I'm happy I could do that because your job is a tough one. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dieterman, for that wonderful presentation. Members, we've come to the end of our time. Before we adjourn, I'd like to wish our illustrious chairman, Representative Schumacher, a very happy birthday. And with that, we are adjourned.